Jim, if I can ask you to join me at the table, and we'll just move into a short Q&A session with the speakers that have presented so far. Before we do that, actually, I think just ask Catherine and Jim, is there anything that you'd like to reflect or comment on each other's presentations?
Like I said, I was lucky to come to the science talk.
I might mention something, because there's an IP issue which is related, really more closely related to exploitation of the science. So there's a move inside a certain academic scientist-based initiative, which is, I'll go back a step. So in existing biotechnology, a lot of the IP is based on description of materials materials that are used for any kind of development, which would be the equivalent of components in synthetic biology. And these are protected and licensed, and so the usual case is that biotech companies will make money out of base patents, which will block other companies from using that technology unless they adopt a license. And that's the conventional approach to licensing technology, and it can be quite restrictive. There's been a move to try and relieve that kind of restrictive practice by having a two-tier IP system where the components are made open source and available, but the applications still can be protected. Try and allow the potential explosion of exchange of reagents and sources that would be useful for other kinds of technologies. And that, I think, there's a Vibrix Foundation, which is a publicly funded organisation which is attempting to get this off the ground, but it's at a rather fragile and susceptible state at the moment, and I think it's most industrial partners don't want that for commercial reasons. But at the moment there's a question of international competitiveness and growth of the field which is at stake here, and whether we want this technology to be democratised, and this is an international aspect of this, whether we want to share the technology with the third world, for example, or have it locked up in the current biotech technology model. And I think there's some serious issues there, which are probably as well as the things that you mentioned.
Yeah, no, I would absolutely agree, but I don't think it's been, like I said, it's interesting, it doesn't seem to be coming up within the international discussions, which it should be. But maybe the reason for that is that at the moment, if they think they open it up to discussion, something will be agreed to soon, when they don't actually know how to develop this properly as a kind of alternative model.
I know, to your right, conference, the book Biology is Technology by Doug Carlson. That picks up on some of those things that you were addressing.
Yeah.
Okay. Questions from the floor. If you'd like to raise your hand if you have a question, please feel free to say your name and if you're representing any particular body before posing your question.
This is a question for Dr. Aslov. My name is Vahana Minana from DEFRA. My question was, how far are the techniques of synthetic biology being explored in improving key food crops, and can you give us some examples of that?
This is very much emergent technology, so the examples I gave are still very much in the laboratory. The base technologies, the foundational technologies, are still being put in place. So there's no immediate plans to put at least the kind of things that I was talking about in the field. However, there's this transitional technology where people are using larger and larger scale conventional technologies. When I say conventional, I mean the bespoke engineering of genetic systems, the GM technology, and clearly I'm sure you're very familiar with the increments there, where more and more genes are being stacked or small pathways being assembled to modify plants or other crop species in different ways. But I think the idea that there'll be a qualitative shift in the kind of things that we can do is something we can see on the horizon now, and we're starting to put those kind of foundational technologies in place in the academic environment. And I think for us anyway, the appeal here is that the approaches are themselves almost intrinsically easier. Once you've got the base technologies in place, the kind of things that you can do, which would be, say, rearranging particular cell types, which might be producing useful components, or rejigging the morphology of a structure, or changing the architecture of a plant. These things, once you've got the base technologies, they're a template that you can apply again and again. So they're potentially quite interesting and relatively quick to apply in other species, I think.
Could I follow that one up? Is it a question of taking the technologies and just applying to see what happens, or are you also relying on quite a good knowledge of systems biology in doing this?
Well, I think there's a very strong bioinformatic and computational base to all the things that we're talking about in these sort of next generation of technologies, and they require additional information about the systems that, so for example, in academic labs, when we're talking about these sort of new phase of developments, there's been a shift over recent years where things like Arabidopsis have been the standard model for development in plants, and that's now shifted in the broader scheme of things more towards crop plants. So people in the research councils, for example, are looking for exploitation of this Mark I genetic GM technology in crop systems. But for us, it's the other way around. And I think this is my screensaver. You might want to close that computer. But that's Mercantia. So we're moving to lower plants because we need to have better systems-based information about the... so if you've got a system where you can make large sweeping changes in terms of a developmental sweep or trajectory, then you need to be able to interface with those key systems. And so we already know from developmental biology that there are key steps in the hierarchy of decision-making in plants. So you need to be able to interface with those and to be able to create things. And we know we can do it because you go to your local supermarket and you'll see crops which we harvest and eat on a routine basis where these things have already been done by genetics. So cauliflowers, cabbages, Brussels sprouts, these are all essentially mutants where you've got changes in developmental pathways which, say, for example, if you're looking at broccoli, every tiny portion of a broccoli, a piece of broccoli, is a small flower, where you've got a mutation which is told that will reprogram the system to make different types of meristems, the same with cauliflower and cabbage, etc. So we know, and from there's a much broader wealth of information from scientific developmental systems, which we know that this hierarchy exists and that we can tap into it. But to do that in an engineering, a rational fashion, rather than a random fashion as a genetic screen, you need to have information about the systems themselves. Absolutely.
I'm Travis Thomas, Programme Director in the Medical Ethics at St Mary's University College London. Thank you very much for a fascinating pairing of talks about the potential of this for good and appeal. And reflection on the sort of industrial revolutions that you were talking about already shows that it's not long before humans do turn their attention to using these for destructive purposes. And I may be preempting something that's coming later on, but with nanotechnology, for example, there's been the added spin, as well as humans using it for ill, the materials themselves may create grey goo in the case of nanotechnology. Anything on the horizon that you can see whereby this technology may, as it were, evolve into something ill in itself?
No, I don't.
Well, I think with biological systems, you've got a wealth of examples where things are either put out of place and have unintentioned and ill effects. And I'm originally from Australia, and there's been a host of European incursions into essentially a virgin continent where you've got everything's feral, from weed species to animal species. And so we have a wealth of examples already where you've got biological systems which are out of balance. But I think, you sound like you might have a sort of rather pessimistic framework that you're working from there, but I mean, I guess from my perspective, the benefits of the technology far outweigh the downsides. I mean, you can always make scenarios, I guess. So if someone's crazy enough to resynthesize smallpox, for example. But there are ways of dealing with that, and you saw that in the regulatory systems, the auto-regulatory systems are being put in place. The synthesis companies will now screen for toxins or viral sequences which might be damaging. I guess it's very difficult to legislate against future technologies which might be applied in a criminal way or in a way that's a rogue state, for example, might sponsor some kind of technology which would be clearly adverse. But we've had a whole, the whole history of human, the whole human history is dotted with events where people have tried to make harmful systems for their own advantage. And as a world society, we obviously have various ways of dealing with that, some successful, not so. But I don't think that the technology, compared to what we're dealing with at the moment, in terms of arms proliferation and arms application, I don't see how it is that much worse. It's clearly a problem. But
thank you. I would say that probably, in the history of man, it's a realistic outlook. I would say a rather pessimistic outlook. I'm very excited about the application of this medicine that takes off. And clearly, there are huge benefits.
Can I just bring some feedback? My name is Mike. I'm from the as a tip, I was very much on the switch of device technology goes extensive further up. What's being done to protect the states?
So I didn't quite catch the, just could you speak up a little bit?
To protect synthetic biology from the bad rats that
have been Well, I think nothing. I think this is something as a society one has to decide, make the balance, the argument has to be taken. And you know, it's a public judgment as to whether the benefits outweigh the risks, and that's something which will play itself out in the public view. And I think as the technology matures, if you think of the plant example, and this is a reasonable good example, and actually the difference between the view, the public's view on medical technologies and agricultural technologies, which are basically the same kind of underpinning DNA modifications, but in one case aimed at new therapies or new drugs, and the other case aimed at improving the bottom line for large agrochemical companies and producers. And in the case of plant GM technology, to date, most of the traits that have been now widely used internationally have little benefit for the consumer. So they're things which improve the producer's lot, they reduce costs, they reduce exposure to pesticides sometimes, and they're generally, you know, it's a relatively benign technology when you look at the application of the risk-benefit analysis in terms of that isolated sphere. But when it comes to the public, there, and certainly in Europe, this came on the back of the BSE controversy, and where GM technology was being imported into Europe from the US, and the consultation with the public was not adequate at that point. And so you have historical coincidence, if you like, with justified concern about BSE and the introduction of new technology without being properly explained and with no real palpable benefit for the consumer. And I think as the technology goes on, you're already seeing more and more benefits for the existing constituency, that is the Monsantos and DuPonts of the world, as well as the farmers themselves. But people are now producing traits which make different crops, for example, they're visually different. So increased head filling in maize, for example, and also for the producers, you're looking at now drought-resistant crops. That's the major trait that's going to be introduced over the next 10 years, which have a major impact in many parts of the world. And also in both micronutrient production for exploitation in Asia and Africa in particular, assuming it's acceptable in those environments. You've got now vitamin A-enriched rice, which is going to go into commercial planting soon, protein-improved potatoes, and micronutrient-improved rice, for example. So all of these things have more clear benefits for the consumer. So one would expect with time that the different attitudes to medical products and agricultural products, which at the moment is quite distinct, may even out somewhat.
My question was sort of basically on the same line where, you know, the whole area of GM has been very sensitive to the UK, and this has mainly contributed to how the publicity about it was initially handled, which was deemed to have done quite badly, that consequently you know, the public is very sensitive to that GM. What do you think we can do to sort of, you know, educate public about the new emerging area of synthetic biology, because the public are not susceptible or willing to, you know, are quite sceptic about GM. They will not accept synthetic biology or anything to do with synthetic biology that threatens them.
Well, I have a fairly relaxed view of it. So I think if something is doing palpable good, if you can produce something which people appreciate and want, the argument just goes away. I mean, to my mind, that's assuming that there's no risks involved in consumption of the materials. And I think in the case of GM crops, I would be quite happy to consume GM crops without any problem. And I think the experiments we've done on we've got 150 million acres of GM crops being grown this year internationally, something like that. And you know, there's been the kinds of traits that are being used have no real health issues. The ecological issues are being largely worked out, and they're nothing compared to the ecological issues with our current agricultural practice and overpopulation. So I think, to my mind anyway, the real issues are, do those products, and it comes down to products, not crops, but products, do they appeal to the consumer, and is it something that people want? And that's really the challenge for the field, and I think that's the reason why you've got such a difference in reputation and regard for GM products that are from the pharmaceutical industry versus the agricultural sector. And I think once that's, you know, once the traits which are coming through the pipeline will readdress that balance.
Thank you very much. I think I'll just draw our first panel there to a close so we can keep as close to time as possible. Thank you very much. There will be further opportunity later on when we have our second set for a full panel discussion. So I'm sure if those of you who have still got burning questions to ask, there will be plenty of opportunity to later on. We will now break for tea and coffee, which will be served out to the left-hand side, my left, your right. I believe that because of the centenary of the Biochemical Society, we even have chocolate Easter eggs for you to get into the Easter mode. So please do avail yourself of all of that through into the Danio office side of the room.